Genesis chapter 20. Let's read Genesis chapter 20. It's pretty much a narrative, and we'll get through it this hour, I think, because it's pretty simple. Starting at verse 1, it says, "Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. Then he journeyed into Gerar. Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, 'She is my sister.' So Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, 'Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is married.' Now Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, 'Lord, will you slay a nation even though blameless? Did he not himself say to me, "She is my sister"? And she herself said, 'He is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this.' Then God said to him in the dream, 'Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you will surely die, you and all who are yours.' So Abimelech arose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, 'What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done.' And Abimelech said to Abraham, 'What have you encountered that you have done this thing?' Abraham said, 'Because I thought surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came about, when God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, "This is the kindness which you will show to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, "He is my brother."' Abimelech then took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. Abimelech said, 'Behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please.' To Sarah he said, 'Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men. You are cleared.' Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids, so they bore children. For the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife." We're going to have the preservation of the promise in this chapter. And what's going to happen is that, as you may have noted as we read through it, that the preservation of the promise is going to have to be done by God, because Abraham refuses to do it. In fact, God's very promise will be put in jeopardy in this chapter. Abraham is going to trade it away for his own personal safety, because he's afraid again that he'll be killed. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Well, it's the same thing he did when he went to Egypt, remember? He said, Sarah's my sister, and the Pharaoh took her that time. So he's fallen into this same trap again, and it'll show us that the promise is going to have to be kept by God and not by man, both morally and physically. In chapter 18 and 19, we had God's justice demonstrated, and we had it demonstrated through Abraham. Remember in his conversation with God, how he talked about, well, your justice would not allow you to destroy Sodom if there were 50 righteous men there, would it? And God said, no, of course not. And Abraham knew that. He wasn't really dickering with God. He knew the answer, but he set it down so we could have that for an example. So God's justice was demonstrated through Abraham. Now in chapter 20, God's justice is going to be demonstrated through Abimelech. Now look at chapter 20, verse 4, where it says, "Now Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, 'Lord, will you slay a nation, even though blameless?' Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself said, 'He is my brother?' In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." And then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." So God's justice is now going to be shown through Abimelech, because Abimelech pleads, "I didn't do anything. You know, they're the ones that lied to me." And God is a just God. He's not going to punish Abimelech for something he didn't do. So Abimelech seems to know this. And note here, the sovereignty of God, even over keeping men from sinning. God says what? "I didn't let you touch her." He hadn't touched her yet. That's why God said to the dream, "I also kept you," in verse 6, "from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." So God prevented that sin. He is sovereign even over that. He did it for a very important reason, because he wanted to preserve his promise and the promised line. And the promised line is going to be who? Isaac. From Abraham to Isaac. Now, Isaac isn't born yet, but it's going to be that way. And God knew that. Abraham should have known it. But Abraham, like I said last hour, this is one of those occasions where he fell flat on his face. Now, on other occasions, Abraham was a giant of faith. And on sometimes he fell on his face, pretty much like all of us. Sometimes the faith just seems to be there, and sometimes it just doesn't. Now, some people have the spiritual gift of faith, and they have much more success at faith than others because it's supernatural. But we all are to have faith, and we all do sometimes, and sometimes we don't. God is protecting his covenant people here. That's why he didn't let Abimelech touch Sarah. Look over at Psalm 105. God protects his covenant people, that is, nation Israel in the Old Testament. And in Psalm 105, verse 13 to 15, he says it flat out. In verse 13, he says, "And they," and that is Israel, "wandered about from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people. He permitted no man to oppress them, and he reproved kings for their sakes. Do not touch my anointed ones, and do my prophets no harm." So God is very careful about protecting his covenant people, his nation Israel, and his prophets. And he's going to call Abraham a prophet, as you notice when we read this chapter, that God calls Abraham a prophet. And we'll look at that word prophet a little bit. It doesn't necessarily mean somebody that tells the future. That's what we think of as prophets, as somebody that can tell the future. That's not the primary function of a prophet, in fact. So the theme, or one of the themes of chapter 20, is going to be that life and death are in the hands of God. We see Abimelech, he believed that. Look at verse 3. It says, "God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, 'Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman you have taken, for she is married.'" Now look down at verse 4. "Now Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, 'Lord, will you slay a nation, even though blameless?' So Abimelech believed that God could and would slay a nation. In other words, Abimelech believed that his life and his death and even his entire nation was in the hands of God. He believed that. Abraham seemed to forget it. In verse 11, it says, Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife." So he seemed to have forgotten that life and death are not in the hands of Abimelech, they are in the hands of God. And that's why we say he kind of fell on his face on this one. Now, before we start, just a note on the name Abimelech. Abimelech is a title. It's not a person's name necessarily. It's like Pharaoh. Pharaoh is a title. Abimelech is a title. It was the title for the king of the Philistines. So when you think of Abimelech, think of it as a title and not a name, because you'll run across it again later in the Old Testament. And you think, wow, this guy's still around? No, it's the title, just like Pharaoh is a title. We start with the complication in verse 1 and 2. And the complication is simply this. The foolish acts of people put God's program in jeopardy. Humanly speaking, of course, God is not going to allow his program to be jeopardized by a human. But isn't that what Abraham is doing here? In verse 2, Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. So Abimelech took her. Now, this could have caused great problems, couldn't it, to the promise and the program of God. What was God's program? It was to have the line, the chosen line, be from Abraham to Isaac. Now, if Abimelech gets in the picture, he could mess that whole thing up. So God's going to have to take care of that. Here we have a map. Here is Hebron, where Abraham started out. And see, he went through the Negev and over here to Gerar. That's his travel. Went down that way for some reason. And the text doesn't say why he went down there. It just says he did. There could have been several reasons. At that time, Gerar was the capital city of the Philistines. It was quite prosperous. Abraham was a very prominent herdsman. He was very wealthy. He might have had business there. He may have gone there because his animals had eaten the pasture and he wanted a better pasture land down there. We don't know. Some reason he decided to go from Hebron anyway, down to Gerar in the midst of the Philistines. And, of course, Abimelech is the king down there. So once again, Abraham passes off his wife as his sister, just like he did down in Egypt. And once again, she is taken by a powerful ruler for a wife, just like she was down in Egypt. So Abraham didn't learn his lesson down there, obviously. Now, there is some differences. In chapter 12, it mentions Sarah's beauty, and it doesn't here. How old is Sarah now? Anybody know? Remember? 90. She's 90 now. So it doesn't mention her beauty. But on the other hand, what God had promised was that Sarah would conceive a child, even in her old age. So there was a regeneration involved. She was past menopause. You cannot conceive a child. So as God rejuvenated her, it may have been a physical, you know, she may have still been quite beautiful. She was a beautiful, beautiful woman to begin with. And people lived longer back then anyway. And when she was 90, if God rejuvenated her, she still could have been quite an attractive woman. Now, on the other hand, Abimelech might have considered her marriageable because of an allegiance he could make with Abraham. You know, Abraham was a very wealthy man. He was a very important man. So Abimelech might have thought, if I marry this guy's sister, you know, we can make an allegiance. We'll be really strong then with him and I both together. We don't know. In chapter 21, verse 22 and 23, it says, "Now it came about at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, 'God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my offspring or with my posterity, but according to the kindness that I have shown to you, and you shall show to me to the land in which you have sojourned.'" So he's trying to make a deal with Abraham over there. And maybe that indicates that the marriage of him and Sarah wasn't a match born in heaven, but one for material gain and power struggles. They did that back in those days. Now, I should mention this before we go any further, that if you read a critical commentary of the Old Testament, the critical scholars say that this chapter, chapter 20, is just a repetition of chapter 12, verse 10 and following. They say it's the same story, just told again. Remember in chapter 12, what happened? Same thing happened overall, but the details were all completely different. In 12:10, it says, "Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe. And it came about, when he came near to Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, 'Now, see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you.'" Geez, that sounds familiar. That's exactly the same thing he's doing up here in Gerar with the Philistines, with Abimelech. So the scholars say, nah, that couldn't be another story. It's just the same story, and they took it and put it in another place. And the reason they say that is because obviously a person wouldn't make that same mistake twice, right? Good. I'm glad to hear that laughter. You know, that's the way scholars are, though. They have to try and come up with something new and different. So they make up things like that. Gee, I'm glad I never made the same mistake twice. I'm being facetious, of course. And the other thing is, it's really easy to say that in theory, but Abraham was in fear of his life. That makes a little difference, doesn't it? So I think the scholars can, you know, take a leap on this one. And I'll stick with the text the way it is. And besides, Abraham flat out admitted in verse 13 of chapter 20 that was his common practice. That's what he did. In verse 13 it says, "When God caused me to wander from my father's house, that I said to her, 'This is the kindness which you will show to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother.'" So that was just his normal routine. Now notice how he kind of tries to lay it off on God here. He says, "When God caused me to wander from my father's house." That's Abraham. The bottom line is God had a plan for Abraham and Sarah. And that plan was that Isaac should be born of them. and it was foolish of them to jeopardize that plan. They knew the plan. Remember, they were told. He said, the angel said, I'm going to come back in a year, and you're going to have a son. And apparently, they forgot that, or Abraham forgot it, but their marriage had to be protected in order for that plan to be fulfilled. So, and in fact, you know, the text doesn't say, but Sarah may have already been pregnant with Isaac at this time, because it's between the time that Jesus told Abraham that he was, you know, in a year's time, I'm coming back, and you'll have a son by the name of, and you'll name him Isaac. So she may very well have been pregnant when all this happened. And we don't know, but they made a very foolish mistake and a bad choice. Boy, I'm glad I never do that. Fortunately for them and for us and for all believers, God is sovereign. And man's idiocy, believer's idiocy, will not change God's program. He won't allow that to happen. No matter what kind of an idiot decision we make, and I include myself, stupid, foolish decisions, he won't let that foul his plan up. So he intervenes. And that's verse 3 through 7, the intervention. God would not allow his promise to Abraham and Sarah to be broken. God doesn't allow things like that. If he promises something, it's going to come to pass. You know, even if we try to mess it up, he's going to make it come to pass. So before Abimelech could come even close to Sarah, God struck him with some kind of an infirmity that prevented it. Look at verse 3 where it says, God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is married. Now, look at verse 17, where it says, Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech. So something, God did something to Abimelech to prevent him from having intercourse with Sarah. So he doesn't allow his promises to be spoiled. He closed up the wombs of all of Abimelech's harem. In verse 18, it says, for the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So their wombs were closed, meaning they couldn't conceive. Abimelech had some infirmity that didn't allow him to go into Sarah. So God took care of things. I mean, big time. Apparently, Abimelech thought that this plague would, in fact, affect his whole nation. In verse 4, he says, now Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, Lord, will you slay a nation, even though blameless? So Abimelech apparently thought God would kill everybody. And he knew God could kill everybody. He was the one who had the faith here, not Abraham. Abimelech had a dream then, and God came to him, and God appeared to Abimelech to explain the significance of what was happening. Abimelech didn't know. He just knew this guy came, and he had a sister, and if he married this guy's sister, he could really make a good arrangement politically and financially and with all the power involved. His defense was that he had only been implicated in the matter because of Abraham. So it kind of looks like Abimelech seems to be aware of God's justice. It doesn't say it outright, but he asked the question just like Abraham did when he said, you won't destroy a city just over, even if there's 50 righteous people left. And Abimelech kind of does the same thing. He says, you won't destroy a nation just because somebody lied to me, because I was spoke in good faith. He had been implicated in the matter because of Abraham's deception. And his response was, first a plea to God's justice, and then he explains his case. What's his case? Well, after he did that, his case was simply, they lied to me. What was I supposed to do? After he explains his case, God acknowledges that Abimelech was innocent, relatively speaking. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in accord with what Abimelech knew and the customs of his day, he was innocent. Now, in the light of absolute morality, was he innocent to have a harem and try to add another wife to his harem? No, even though there wasn't any law against it back then. But relatively speaking, he was innocent, and God acknowledged that, and therefore God prevented him from sinning. Look at verse 6. Then God said to him in the dream, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. So God knows, and God acknowledges that he is, relatively speaking, he's innocent in his eyes. Notice who the sin is against. It says in verse 6, I also kept you from sinning against Abraham, right? No, the sin is against God. When we sin against each other, in the final analysis, that sin is always against God. Look up at Acts. Look up at Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9, and we're talking about Paul, who was Saul then, on the road to Damascus, and his Damascus road experience. Let's start at verse 1. It says, now Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked for letters from him to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, both men and women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. As he was traveling, it happened that he was approaching Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. And he fell to the ground, and he heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting my people? Wait a minute. That's not what my text says. It says, why are you persecuting me? So when we sin against other believers, yes, we're sinning against other believers, but ultimately that sin is against God. We see the same thing back in Genesis chapter 20. Abimelech was going to sin against God. So God prevented him from doing that. So God gives Abimelech some instructions. First, he tells him to restore Sarah to Abraham, and then to ask Abraham to pray for him to be healed. Verse 7, now therefore restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you will surely die, you and all who are yours. So he gives Abimelech the orders there to restore Sarah, to ask Abraham to pray for him. So what does Abimelech do? His response in verse 8 through 10 is first a stinging rebuke to Abraham. And I think he had the right to rebuke Abraham. Abraham played him for a sucker. And verse 8 says, "So Abimelech arose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened." So he wanted some witnesses here, so he told all his servants, and then he called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." So he really rebukes Abraham. He said, "Why in the world did you do this? You know, it was kind of a dirty thing to do." Notice his motivation for returning Sarah to Abraham doesn't seem to be his remorse over sinning against Abraham. It's so his country doesn't get destroyed and him along with it. So Abraham comes up with some lame excuses in verse 11 to 13. Verse 11 says, "Abraham said, 'Because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife.'" So that's his first excuse, because the Philistines did not fear God. They may have killed him and taken his wife anyway. So his reasoning, the same as in Egypt, well, if I go in there and they kill me and take my wife, what's the difference if I just give her to him? That way I'll still be alive. And that's his reasoning here, as well as it was down there. No, they're going to take her anyway, and then they'll kill me. Now, apparently, Abraham thought that God's power stopped at the gates of Gerar. He apparently thought, well, God, he can't work inside this city because they have no fear of God here. Come on, Abraham. Now, notice something in the text here. Abimelech doesn't deny this. He doesn't deny it. That may have been a legitimate fear. But could God take care of it? Of course he could. Abraham just needed to trust him, and he didn't. So, you know what? We see when we read in the text that God really lays it on to Abimelech, doesn't it? He really chastises him. He says, "Man, I prevented you from touching her. If you don't give Sarah back right now, I'm going to kill you and all your people." But he never rebukes Abraham. And what do you suppose? It might be because Abraham was right, and Abimelech was planning on killing him and taking his wife and all his possessions. Text doesn't say, so we can't say that for sure, but it is a plausible theory. Now, his next excuse. First excuse, well, you would have killed me and taken her anyway. Second one, she's my stepsister. I didn't really lie to you because I said she was my sister, and she really is my sister. And that's verse 12. "Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife." So he's, yeah, lame excuses here, you know. "Oh, you would have killed me anyway. Well, she really is my sister. I didn't really lie to you." And verse 13, "I do this all the time anyway." Isn't that what verse 13 says? "It came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, 'This is the kindness which you will show to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother.'" So those are Abraham's lame excuses. "Oh, you would have killed me anyway. And she really is my sister. And I do this all the time." You know? It sounds silly, doesn't it, when you put it in those terms? But that's exactly what he's saying here. So what's the outcome of this whole thing? Well, first, Abimelech restored Sarah to Abraham. In verse 14, it says, Abimelech then took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. So not only did he give Sarah back, he gave him gifts, a large gift as a matter of fact, sheep, oxen, servants, freedom to dwell anywhere he wants to in Abimelech's land, the land of the Philistines. Verse 15, Abimelech said, Behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please. So he gave him all of these things and 1,000 pieces of silver to boot. Verse 16, to Sarah he said, Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you and before all men you are cleared. And then, of course, Abraham prayed to God, and Abimelech and his household were healed. In verse 7, it says, Now therefore restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. And I said we'd get to this word, the word prophet. And Abraham, this is the first use of that word in the Bible, the word prophet. It says, Abraham is a prophet. The word is from the Hebrew word Navi. Navi means a spokesman, or a speaker for another, one who speaks for another, a spokesperson, especially God's spokesperson. And that's what a prophet was in the Old Testament. He was a spokesman for God. Not necessarily one who could tell the future. That was the test of a prophet. How do you want to know if a prophet really is speaking for God? Well, have him predict the future and he can do it. That was the test. If he could do it every time without fail, then he was a prophet from God. If he failed once, kill him. So it's kind of tough to be a prophet. I mean, you had to be right all the time. The people today who read tarot cards and say they're prophets, I bet they wouldn't want to be subjected to the Old Testament test of a prophet. And they had to make short-term prophecies, not only long-term prophecies. You know, you could say, well, in 4,000 years, something's going to happen, and you wouldn't have to worry about being proven wrong. But in the Old Testament, the prophets made short-term prophecies and long-term prophecies so they could be tested. And it wasn't a prophecy like, the sun will rise tomorrow morning. You know, God told me that. Boy, he's been right 3 days in a row. Now, it wasn't something like that. They were very specific prophecies, as we looked at in Daniel. Some of the prophecies were so specific, it just boggles your imagination. And in fact, some of the prophecies in Daniel are so specific that the critical scholars say, well, this book had to have been written at a later date because nobody could know that much about the future, which is silly, of course, because God knows about the future. So it's a spokesman. His job was to speak the words of God. That was the job of the prophet in the Old Testament. Remember, they had three offices in the Old Testament, and you could never be more than one of them. There was the prophet and the king and the priest. The prophet was God's spokesman to the people. The priest was the people's spokesman to God, and the king was the ruler of the people. So they had those three different positions in the Old Testament, and no one could be more than one of them. If they tried, terrible things happened to them. We looked at that in the prophecy class. Terrible things happened if you tried, if a king tried to be a priest or a priest tried to be a king or vice versa. Jesus Christ is a king, a prophet, and a priest. He's the only one. That's why no one in the Old Testament was allowed to do it, because that was reserved for him. The final outcome of this whole thing, chapter 20, is Abraham seems to have finally learned his lesson. Because as we read on through the life of Abraham, we won't see him doubting God anymore. We won't see him not trusting God anymore. So he seems to have finally learned his lesson. And let's pray that we can learn that same lesson without having to go through all the knocks that Abraham did. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the story of Abraham and Abimelech. Father, we pray that we can learn the lesson from this so that we won't have to go through it ourselves in order to learn it. And the lesson is very simple. We're to trust you and not the world. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.